I was raised by a single mother, was very adamant that that will not be the case for me, and that I will, and I have established and built a relationship with my family there, and I had to maintain it intentionally. And that's where I get my inspiration from. You know, I'm very aware of their struggles. You know, I know that my cousin, who is slightly older than I am, has worked at a sock factory, an American sock factory. So you might be wearing one of his socks for most of his adult life. And we, you know, he's a very creative person and he loves theater and he has all of these gifts that he was never, the society does not, doesn't value it. And there's no place for it, right? It's not, the economy doesn't support that.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Alfredo González Valenzuela, and you are now at the Climate Frontline. Good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you may be. My name is Alfredo González Valenzuela, and you are now at the Climate Frontline podcast, the show where I engage with leaders in social movements, industries, and artists to have conversations that center those communities that are at the front line of climate change. And our community does this, we do this one conversation at a time. So today, I am happy to welcome a friend of mine, Evelyn Ferreira, to the show. Evelyn, welcome.
Hi, Alfredo. Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Evelyn, for those folks that may not know who you are, please share what is it that you do and also share what your favorite food is.
Well, I will start with what I do. So my name's Evelyn. I live in Portland, Oregon. I am of Hondureña descent y Dominicana también. Grew up in New Jersey and New York City. And the work that I do revolves around zero waste work. I consider myself an entrepreneur. At this point, I'm working on starting a zero waste and zero emissions shipping and delivery service, serving the Pacific Northwest, and hopefully, if all goes well, nationally as well. And to answer the second question, my favorite food, my guilty pleasure is, not even guilty, I love it, is vanilla ice cream with whipped cream and rainbow colored sprinkles. Timeless. I loved it since I was a kid. I will love it till the day I die. It will always put me in a good mood.
Wow. That was it. Very specific. I was not expecting that, but okay. That's awesome. Thanks for being in the show. You know, it's so good to be with you because it's been a couple years now since we've known each other, you know, and in this episode, I really want to make space to still talk about language and still talk about our different roles we have and environmental justice and climate change and so on and so forth. But I want to give also a space to, you know, talk about how we're experiencing this time that is post-election, but also a time that is difficult for both Honduras and Peru. And so, yeah, again, thanks for being with me today. You know, it's very interesting, at least for me. I like to start off and share that, like, recently the Peruvian Congress took out the president in Peru. And so in the past 4 years, we've had three presidents. And I just imagine what the United States, or what we refer to often as the United States, you know, what would it be like if in the past 4 years, the United States had three different presidents? Maybe we wouldn't be talking to each other right now, you know? And so that just speaks, I think, this recent decision by the Congress, it speaks volumes about the situation that is taking place all across Peru, or what is now referred to as Peru. And it leaves a little bit of uncertainty and despair. A lot of people are angry at this new news, basically. But I also know that Honduras is facing different things right now. And I would just love to hear what is it that you're hearing from the relationships, really, right? Because ultimately, relationships are something that I think tie us to the work and tie us to the pulse. That's what's going on in the global South, if you will.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm very sorry to hear about, you know, everything that's going on in Peru. And I can't imagine what that is like. And I know that we've experienced a lot of turmoil in the U.S., but nothing like that yet. In Honduras, I consider myself very fortunate to still have a relationship with my family. So I am second generation. My mother immigrated to the United States in the 80s, and I was born in the U.S., and she was very adamant about building a relationship with my family in Honduras. So she would fly me out as often as she could. And I built a relationship with them. I'd spend my summers there. And now, you know, I didn't go for a long time just because, you know, I had to pay my own ticket down there. But eventually, like over the last, I would say like 7 to 10 years, I've been rebuilding a relationship with them out of my own accord, and making sure that I'm visiting and tuning in. And as these issues intensify, I'm realizing that it's more important than ever that I continue to build relationships both with my family and some friends that I have down there. And this week, this weekend, so the weekend of November 7th in Honduras and Central America, they experienced Hurricane Eta. It was a Category 4 storm. And it was very, very devastating for many communities across Central America. In Honduras, from what my family has told me and some family friends as well, you know, they were really impacted by the rains. So they didn't get as heavy winds, luckily for them, but they did experience a lot of heavy rains, which ended up, you know, flooding major parts of the city and towns. And then also they experienced a lot of like landslides and mudslides. And
yeah, I was going to say
that, you know, so Honduras, right? What is Honduras means? Hondo, Honduras, waves, right? So when you drive around the countryside, you see the topography is very hilly. That's what it means.
Yeah.
So when there's, you know, flash rains or prolonged rains, because it rained for like 3 or 4 days straight, a lot of the rivers ended up flooding over. Anyone who lived in a low-lying area was flooded out. My partner's sister's home was flooded entirely up to the roof. I can't imagine what that's even like. And they weren't given much notice. That's also something that I find really interesting. And I want to hear more about from them. You know, how much warning did they have? I think they had a couple of hours to evacuate. But they knew that there was a hurricane coming, but no one really informed them of the risk that was involved. And that's why I think they've seen and experienced a lot of loss of life because of this. And I have seen some really graphic images as well of people buried and entire families buried in landslides. It's tragic, and depending on, I would say it's unacceptable as well, and we can get into the details of what that means.
Yeah. And so yeah. What systems are in place for these people to get some help at this moment in time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So from what I've been following and from what my family has told me, and I just wrapped up a phone call with a cousin right before hopping onto our conversation. So El Salvador has offered assistance. So they flew in a number of their military people, medical personnel to assist. And I think they'll be there for anywhere from like 7 to 10 days assisting. From what the Honduran government is doing, I know that they've been on doing rescue missions, so helping people that have been trapped. And they are providing food and some shelter, but no financial assistance to people who have lost their homes. And they will not receive anything from the government. And apparently the government has made it very clear that they don't have the funding to assist people beyond, you know, this emergency assistance right now, which is basic shelter at, like, you know, maybe at churches that have not been affected or locations like that, and food. And who knows if that food is indefinite. I'm not really clear on those details. And then I know some of the other countries have also volunteered. They've sent over volunteers to assist. But again, that's short term, and it's not going to resolve people's longer term needs, which is replacing all of the loss, right? The loss of the material goods as well, right? Like, if you lose your home and you work hand to mouth and you've been working 10, 20 years just to build your house and buy the things that you own, and you're left with nothing, right? So this is going to have devastating effects on people, on the economy, and I'm an optimist, so I'm also curious to see how can people come together in the absence of money. So my understanding right now is that in areas that were severely flooded, the banks aren't open, grocery stores aren't open, so money is not available. So how do you come together in community when there is no money? How do you trade? How do you support each other? And, you know, I wonder, how can we build community or rebuild community in the absence of money? Yeah. And that's a, you know, a bigger discussion in terms of, like, what is money? Who does money benefit? And why was money created?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a disruption, right? And I think disruptions also give us an opportunity to see what can change, right? And I'm curious to know, as I heard you speaking about this issue, and for those listeners that are tuning in, you know, this could be a really strong conversation from the get-go, but, like, these are the conversations that we have, right? And so I think we need to do some justice at just making this space ours. We're already speaking in English for the audience, and I think we're meeting you halfway already. So if you're tuning in, like, hold on to your seats, because we're going to get deeper. But also, I want to spend some time in, like, culture and how is it that we move forward. Getting back to the question I have in my mind, though, you know, as we were talking earlier, I got a chance to travel from Costa Rica all the way to Mexico with my mochila, you know, with the backpack and whatnot. And there's this narrative, there's this stigma, if you will, right, that Costa Rica and the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico are, like, the places for tourists to go. They're safe spots, you know, and you have a lot of tourists, a lot of people from Europe. And I'm not saying this because, you know, I Googled this. I've been there and I've seen it, you know. And so there's this also narrative that is negative with Honduras and El Salvador. And I'm just curious to know, what are your reactions to that? And you know, what is it like to be there and actually, like, live it, you know, because your family is there and you go visit often, your relationships are there. So my gut tells me that there's a deeper story, a different narrative there. And I would just love for you to build that narrative.
And I can only speak to that as someone who's multicultural, born and raised in the United States. You know, the longest I've been in Honduras has been, like, 2 to 3 months at a time, multiple times, but, like, that's kind of, like, the longest I've been there. And, you know, that's a different perspective than someone who was raised there, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, so just keeping that in mind. What's interesting, so I was born and raised in the U.S. On the East Coast, New York City area, and there aren't that many Hondureños out there. A lot of Hondureños are on the West Coast, L.A. area, and Salvadoreños también. And I grew up, you know, I came of age in the 90s, early 2000s, and the narrative has been that, you know, there are a lot of drug cartels and it's unsafe. And, you know, it's a very, like, you know, you've got migrants and coming from Central America, coming, you know, taking trains or, you know, busing it all the way up to the border. And
the caravans to Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah, the caravans and, you know, crime. Crime has been a big deal. And this is a war on drugs that I'm so grateful is finally getting more attention, especially with the legalization of cannabis, more and more across the country. Like, we're realizing, and I'm sure, like, we don't even have to tell BIPOC twice that, like, the war on drugs is BS, right? And it has devastated communities, and it has devastated, I would say it has devastated Central America and much of Latin America as well. And I remember watching the news with my mom, because my mom would always put on Telemundo, like, every morning. That's what we would listen to. So I'm like, I've been watching the news every day since I was a kid. And this has been going on nonstop, and it doesn't get as much attention now. I don't really know what the status is right now of, like, the war on drugs in Central America, but I remember it devastated communities, and, like, the fact that it has also, Central America has gotten a very, Honduras and El Salvador specifically, have gotten such bad reputations because of the crime. And, you know, some of it, I would say, like, yes, the crime is real. Yes, like, when I traveled to Honduras, like, during the 90s and 2000s, like, my family, like, everyone, you'd take off all your jewelry at the airport. You know, you wouldn't even bring it. You would be just a regular, simple person, because it was a safety issue. It was a public safety issue. And that is how infiltrated, I would say, and the gangs, I would, you know, for lack of better words, like, were present. You know, they were well organized. And my family lives in a smaller town, smaller city. It's still, it's a port city called Puerto Cortes. And, you know, everyone would be home by 7 p.m. It wasn't safe to be out at night. And that's still pretty much the case. And, you know, hijackings and people getting pulled over in their vehicles, you know, smuggling drugs, shootings like that. It's still common. It still happens. But I think it was very common and very present in the day-to-day life of Hondureños. And that is why so many, I think there's just been so much immigration. One of the reasons why there's been so much immigration to the U.S. over the last, you know, 20, 30 years is because it's a very challenging and difficult place to live. Yeah. For that reason. It has been very violent, and I would say it's U.S., you know, backed violence.
Yeah. What I'm hearing from you is, like, two things. It's like, one is, like, yeah, there is some truth to that narrative from the perspective that you've had as a multicultural person that's navigated both worlds. But what I'm also hearing is that, like, there's been an influence from the US, and I'm sure also Europe, as drugs are transported over, because folks in the United States, los gringos, they want some drugs, right? And so, like, they have to get through it somehow, and these countries are just, you know, another port there. And so I appreciate both of your perspectives. It's been interesting to hear you say that, because some folks that I met over there too, you know, let me know that there was the violence piece, but there's also a lot of history in Honduras, right? And there's a lot of culture there that I think is put underneath the rug, for a lack of a better term, with the violence and everything that is happening. So you've been working to kind of pivot to a different part of the conversation. You've been working now in the quote unquote sustainability space for a couple of years now, and you still have these relationships back in Honduras. So I'm curious to know, you know, what does it look like for you to be doing the work over there as it relates to sustainability, or we were just talking about earlier, the sustainable development goals. I'm curious to know how it is that you see that. It may be that you haven't done work directly, but I'm just curious to know what is the language there that you would use to engage people on these topics, especially with Huracan Eta taking place right now. Like, to what extent are people talking about this, are acting on it, or just becoming more aware of it as an issue?
So I had to check in with my family and the people there just to know what's in the main, like in the mainstream awareness. And from what my cousin, who does, you know, watch, I would say the like los noticiarios, the mainstream news, he said they do mention climate change, but very seldomly, you know, not regularly. And that the average person doesn't understand the science behind climate change and why it's happening. And the government isn't doing much to explain and make sure, like really express the urgency behind it, because it doesn't benefit them to do that, right? So like in the case of Huracan Eta, if they had communicated to the people, hey, we are a frontline community, right? We are very vulnerable to climate change. People are going to freak out, you know, and it could cause a lot of chaos. It would make people obviously scared and nervous. And lo and behold, something like Eta happens, and then something like Huracan Eta happens and people are wondering, well, why is this happening? And that is what I really hope, waking people up to the fact that climate change is happening and that it exists and that it is something that the government may not talk about. And that's also the part that's, I think, very frightening for folks, because I'm sure folks are probably asking themselves, well, is this going to happen again? Mm-hmm. Is it safe for me to live here? And the answer is no, because if your house was flooded from this one storm because you live, you know, close to the river, you know, how many rivers are going through Central America? So many, right? Where are you going to go? And the government doesn't have probably the awareness to, or the means to explain to people, we're going to have to relocate everybody.
Yeah.
You know, what's the responsible thing to do? Relocate folks. Really talk about, with, you know, build a consortium or a coalition with other Central American countries. Okay, well, let's look at our geography as a whole and identify what areas are vulnerable to flooding again, because we can't rebuild here. It's not safe to. And that's the fear that I feel, especially in the context of having had, you know, an extended family member lose their home in this. It's like, well, should they move back there? Because it's very likely that it'll happen. Maybe it won't happen this year, but it could happen next year again. And now that they saw how easily the rivers flooded, you know, a river can flood again anytime. You know, it's not unheard of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to hear you speak about this, because when you used the term frontline, and I mean, this is the climate frontline, you know, and I just, when I also think about, you know, how I engage those folks who are quote unquote at the front line in Peru or somewhere else, maybe even just here in California or the Pacific Northwest, wherever it may be, you know, unless you're here in the United States and have had that education and awareness, you're not going to go up to them and say, hey, you're the vulnerable, or hey, you're the front line, you know. They're going to call themselves as they are, like we are this barrio or this neighborhood, or we are Latinos, we are Peruvians. Heck, even the Latinx construct has been interesting to dive into. And so it's interesting to hear you speak about them in this way, because you're right in so many ways, unless there's that education and awareness building, I would say more so with these communities, then it doesn't move forward, right? And that's closely tied to politics. And regardless whether it's Honduras or El Salvador or the next country, if there's no politics willing to step up in that way, then it's like you're back at square one, right? And it drains my soul to be in that despair, because like, where does it leave people like you, or, you know, other people who may have roots in Central America? Like, what is it that you do? And I know you've done a couple campaigns to fundraise money and support your family members over there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in terms of where does that leave us, especially for us who live abroad, or, you know, we're not living in the countries that are most affected directly right now. I think, one, we're coming at this from a place of privilege, right? We're physically safer. And I intend, and I've made it my intention to incorporate this into my life's work, which is advocating as well for communities. And I would love to meet and connect with, I'm really interested in land use, and how we can work with the land. And I know that Honduras specifically has experienced a lot of drought over the last decade. And what my cousin, when I checked in with him, he told me that Hurricane Eta was actually good for some areas that hadn't gotten any water in a long time. So there was a lake that had been dry for a few years now, and that it completely filled up with all of the rain that came. So, you know, I'm sure that there will also be areas that may come back to life with the water that they've gotten. But longer term, you know, those are questions that how can we preserve and restore the natural habitats and the natural ecosystems of Central America, which are, you know, it's rainforest, and it's very important that we preserve that and take care of that. And as someone from the outside, I would really love to support in that work and make sure that it's getting done, and make sure that we are holding the American and other, you know,
because the U.S. is intertwined in those politics. So if we're not addressing politics here in the U.S., then you can't really fight the politic fight back home, right?
Yeah. And even beyond politics, you know, we consume a lot of fruits and vegetables from Central America. Honduras is the banana republic. So that's where a lot of our bananas come from. So my hope and dream is that every time someone eats a banana, which, you know, so many
people
do, have
a moment of clarity or think about it deeper, right?
Totally. So
I thought you were going to pull a plot twist and tell me that the vanilla ice cream with whipped cream and whatnot is originally from Honduras.
No.
Hey, so I'm curious to know also, like, so you're doing work with waste, you know, here in the U.S., and there's, you know, plenty of other people, because I've been in the waste field also, that are doing that work. How do these experiences you have and relationships you have shape the work you do and guide you in a different way? Because they're important relationships you have, right? And ultimately they shape the more holistic view, I would describe it as, that you have of what's going on as it relates to this larger problem or system of problems called climate change.
Definitely. You know, I really think that when we think about systems and we think about, you know, social justice and we think about reparations as well, how can we really make up, how can the United States, you know, I am born here, but I don't consider myself, whatever, the United States, how can the United States as an entity, as a nation, support and help mitigate or make up for, you can't make up for, you know, centuries of damage that you have done or imposed on, you know, multiple countries. It's not just Honduras, you know, other countries have also experienced a lot of suffering as a result of what just happened. Our power went out.
Well, that's symbolic. That's symbolic in many different ways. Well, I'm glad you're still with me. I think
I'm gonna get a flashlight, but I'm here with you.
You know, this is actually really cool, because like this is what happens in Latin America, right? Like the light will go off whenever you may not even have hot water, and it's like, this is the reality that people live in. And so like, I think in any other moment, the podcast would have stopped recording, but like, I actually think that this is capturing the realities that many people, or at least a little stint of the realities that many people in Latin America are facing. So,
you know, to answer the original question of how does my, how would I like to see my work involved with Latin America? I would really like to see corporations, you know, not just, you know, the company that I'm working to build, but also many companies realize that, like, maybe your supply chain is in some way, shape, or form connected to, you know, raw goods or raw materials that come from Latin America. And it is imperative that that in some way benefits the people, whether it's through fair labor practices. And we know we struggle with that. You know, like even here in the United States, we are not paying our farm workers a living wage, and we're certainly not taking care of them with basic benefits. And that certainly does not happen in Latin America. I know so many people, elders, that do not have Social Security and will not have, will have to work hand to mouth until, you know, the day they pass away, because there are no public programs to do that, and there's no funding. So I really would love to see the day in my lifetime when we are able to see North America, Central America, and South America really come together. But especially North America and Central America that have, you know, that there's a really strong relationship between, and it's an abusive relationship between the two nations or the two areas, the two geographies, really come together and realize that we can't just take, and that it is within our means to give as the wealthiest nation in the world at this point. And if anything, you know, obviously reparations to African Americans and to Native peoples in North America are incredibly important, but we must not forget about communities in Central America that have also been raped and pillaged for, I mean, those are, that's, that, those are the exact words, as a result of North American and American practices.
Yeah. So tell me, in how, in all this, like, I'm curious to know, where is it that you getting your inspiration and energy to move forward? Cause like, you know, we just went through a bunch of things that are going on, and I think many people would tune out, you know, they would say, hey, you know, like, this is my weekend, this is my holiday, and like, I need to just take care of myself. And that's fine. Like, I get it. I'm not trying to push people into not taking care of themselves, especially with mental health, suicides, drug addiction, and other things. Like, I'm not trying to silver line that as means of like getting you to listen into the podcast. But what I am saying, though, is that those same issues that I just named still exist in Honduras, still exist in Peru, still exist throughout Global South countries. And they don't have a choice to just turn the page or you know, turn down the volume. The next morning, they're still going to be there. So to kind of put it on you, like, where is it that you gain some inspiration, or where is it that you find hope as you move forward in all this?
Well, I gained my inspiration in knowing that I would be doing my ancestors, even the ones that I know now, my family, a huge disservice by forgetting about them. And I had to come to terms with this fairly recently in my, like, as an adult, you know, as an American living in the U.S., and this is true of many Latinos, we have a choice. And sometimes we're presented with it, and sometimes we don't. I you know, I know folks whose parents never connected them with their culture, their culture of heritage, right? Whether they just never traveled back to their countries of origin, or they just don't know their families anymore. And you assimilate, right? That's what a lot of us do in America, in the United States. We assimilate. We assimilate to the dominant culture, which is, you know, whatever it may be in your neighborhood or in the area that you grew up in. However, my mother, I was raised by a single mother, was very adamant that that will not be the case for me, and that I will, and I have established and built a relationship with my family there, and I had to maintain it intentionally. And that's where I get my inspiration from. You know, I'm very aware of their struggles. You know, I know that my cousin, who is slightly older than I am, has worked at a sock factory, an American sock factory. So you might be wearing one of his socks for most of his adult life. And we, you know, he's a very creative person and he loves theater and he has all of these gifts that he was never, the society does not, doesn't value it. And there's no place for it, right? It's not, the economy doesn't support that type of expression. So to see that in the people that I love, that they have not been able to fulfill their full potential and that they struggle financially as much as they do, you know, like to make $300 to $500 a month, that's on average what they make, right? And that doesn't go very far because I noticed it when I went there. Food is very expensive. So I get my inspiration by really connecting to current events and the people on the ground. And I will continue to do that through the relationships that I'm building and continuing to build. And that's been very important to me to not assimilate. And I will continue making that decision over and over again. And I recognize that like the day, you know, if and when I choose to have children, it's like, it is my intention to teach them Spanish. It's not just going to happen. That's something that I will do intentionally because I value the relationship or what it affords. It affords communication with a whole continent. It affords, language. You know, language, right. It's special and it's special to me. And that's what inspires me every day. And the hope of seeing Honduras and its people thriving because it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And the people are really beautiful. And frankly, they're very traumatized. You know, yeah. My cousins have told me like we're traumatized from the struggle.
Yeah. There's lots of trauma there. And even for folks that have come to the United States, there's still trauma to be healed from. Right. And I think for me now, having my life in Peru and also the US, like there's a whole struggle of fitting in one or another, you know, and like, and I empathize with what you're sharing there. I'm curious what your message would be to, you know, folks who may be listening to you right now, who spend some time, whether that's, you know, their parents spend the time in Honduras, El Salvador, and another country, and then immigrated at an early age, or like you came as a second generation immigrant, through your parents or through your mom specifically, as you've shared, what is the message that you share with them as they, you know, try to go day by day with this reality that, that they're living from afar?
Well, I think that I empower, my advice is that everyone, you know, who's bicultural, you know, think about it and make a decision for oneself about what kind of relationship you want to have with your heritage, with your ancestors, with the land, and with language as well. And make it something that's intentional. Don't just let it happen to you. Don't just forget Spanish gradually and never make a choice. Because it's all a choice. I think we do have that choice. And the other like words that I would really love to see this, I would love to see, and I don't want to generalize Latinos in the United States, but I do want to say like young Latinos living across the states. Maybe like the one thing we do have in common is that like we have a recent trackable, traceable heritage, right? You know, we probably know like where our parents came from or where our grandparents came from. And that it's going to be really important for our survival and our survival as, you know, in the context of climate change, right, of this podcast, and in the context of social justice, we have to come together and we have to build communities, and we cannot be, you know, something that I struggled with subconsciously has been shame around being Latina in a white, predominantly white culture. And we have to, I feel like I need to get over that, and I'm working on that. And it's going to be more important than ever to reclaim that. And I'm seeing it really beautifully amongst like Native tribes and Indigenous folks, like starting to reclaim the power that does exist within us and within our heritage and our cultural practices, and learning about them, reclaiming them, investigating what those are, because a lot of what colonization has been is removing us and separating our ancestors, maybe not, you know, many generations ago, from traditional practices, whether it's traditional practices of, you know, I love architecture and design. So like, how can we build more sustainably in a way that's like aligned with the planet? And those are practices that have been around forever. Like, we have those answers. We just need to reclaim them and learn about them.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Evelyn. Totally. It's been a gift really to get to know you in different ways. You know, I remember still meeting you the first time, interviewing you. We speak in Spanish, English, Portuguese. We've had difficult conversations between us two. And I think the one thing that I really appreciate about you is how relational you are. And I think in this conversation with you, that really comes through, is that you are in tune to the relationships you still have back in Honduras. And so thank you for being at the Climate Frontline podcast. Are there any other thoughts or anything else you'd like to share as we sign off?
No, I really appreciated that final question. And, you know, I really look forward to the amazing things that I think we're going to really do as, you know, as a racial group, as a cohort as well. And, you know, personally to Alfredo, I really appreciate the work that you're doing to create a space to give us some airtime to really connect with, give frontline communities the airtime that we absolutely need. And, you know, there's so many frontline communities at this point. It's important. So thank you.
And how can folks reach out to you, get connected to you and the work and the initiatives you're doing?
Absolutely. So I would love for everyone to visit my website, my company website. It's Earthen, Earthen Exchange, Exchange, earthenexchange.co. And from there, you'll see the really awesome project that I'm working on, company that I'm building. And I really hope that it can impact the lives of many, many people, and also, most importantly, the environment. So you can stay tuned there, and everyone's more than welcome to follow me on LinkedIn and social media as well.
Evelyn Ferreira, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much.
So that was my conversation with Evelyn. I hope you enjoyed it. I think it was a very timely conversation, especially with Hurricane Eta striking Honduras and much of the Gulf, as well as these things happening in Peru. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean a lot for me if you are able to do that. Also, as I stated last episode, there is going to be a drawing or a raffle of some items that I have here for the holiday season. All you have to do is go to climatefrontline.com and sign up for the newsletter, or simply go on follow me on Instagram and Facebook at The Climate Frontline, and send me a message just letting me know your favorite takeaway or anything you appreciate, and you'll be entered in. So we'll be doing a drawing at the end of November, and I have different gifts that I would like to share with this community. I also wanted to invite you to Community Week, the week between the 22nd and 28th of November, where we're going to change the narrative around what is quote-unquote Thanksgiving. And so I have amazing speakers lined up for you for that week, and we're going to change the narrative one conversation at a time. And that will conclude the first season of the Climate Frontline podcast. So be sure to be following us on the different social media platforms and stay tuned for Community Week coming up. I will see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye. The communities who are experiencing the worst effects of climate change are those who are best positioned to innovate solutions. Thank you for tuning in and being part of Changing the Narrative. See you next time at the Climate Frontline.